Crickle ward, you stole my youth away. For I was young and innocent, and you were old and grey.
Cor Corrum, the columns of Alan Corrum. Part 4, Out to Lunch.
The only time I lunched with the Queen, the first words she said to me were, "Have you any idea what a trial it is to own a golf course?" I don't remember what I mumbled, but I do remember reflecting that when it came to preemptive strikes, my sovereign left Admiral Yamamoto at the post. I had turned up at her palace with my conversation fleet dressed overall. There was not a potential topic I hadn't buffed to shimmering nick. There was not a drollery unprimed. But she dived on me out of the sun, and her first wave had devastated me. My battleships were going down by the stern, my carriers were ablaze, and where my submarines had once lurked, there were now but pitiable patches of flotsam dotted oil. She then launched, while the prawn hung trembling on my fork, into a hilarious account of the shenanigans at her Windsor Links, where a demarcation dispute between groundsmen and gardeners had left the fairways unmown. When she finished, she asked my advice as to her best course of action. I put the prawn down and mumbled something else, drawn this time from my vast experience of owning golf courses, whereupon she said, "Was there an exact date when workmen stopped wearing boots? You never see boots on workmen anymore." The whole of, let us call it our conversation, followed this bizarre unpattern. The monarch unfalteringly displaying a serial penchant so relentlessly nimble it left the clodhopper winded. It was like going 10 rounds against a class flyweight trained by René Magritte and managed by P.G. Woodhouse. By the end of 3 hours, I had pledged my life to her. Here was wackiness of an order so incomparable it must have been hers by divine right. She was barking regal. Her husband? I first met him some years before when, as rector of St. Andrews, I attended the investiture of Magnus Magnusson as rector of Edinburgh, where Prince Philip was chancellor. We were all in the robing room, struggling into our floor-length velvet numbers, when the consort suddenly cried, "If we were stark naked under these, nobody would be any the wiser." He then laughed for a very long time. It thus came as no surprise when, soon after, their son stopped doing bluebottle impressions and began confiding in Flora, leaving me with a conviction rendered all the more unshakable by the Princess Royal, who, when I invited her to a punch lunch and apologised for limping on a swollen knee, said, "Yes, it's been a ghastly year for equine VD. Did you know it can cause rheumatoid arthritis in jockeys? Everyone's taking phenylbutazone." What am I trying to tell you here? Merely that I have been growing daily more irritated by demands for the royal family to shape up, remember who they are, and behave accordingly. Because my view is that is precisely what they are doing. They are a very odd lot, and they stand in a long and remarkably impressive line of highly peculiar figures, of whom this country ought never to cease for one instant to be proud. Hitherto we have cherished them for this astonishing distinction. Edward II, Richard III, Henry VIII, Elizabeth I, Charles II, George III and IV, Edward VII and VIII, and I pick only the royal tree's fruitier plums, the ones we relish most for their egregious lusts and vagaries and misdemeanours, for even the dullest have had their moments, be it George V's terminal injunction to Bugger Bognor, or that exercise of Victoria's remarkable libido which, indulging itself at Windsor, could rattle windows in Cardiff. So why are we distressed now at what delighted us before? Whence this nonsense requiring the current lot to be moral exemplars and behavioural models? Because if they won't, then it's all up with them. They have never been anything of the sort. What they have been is a collection of flaky English eccentrics, beyond the dreams of Ealing Studios, as thankfully unlike their subjects as it's possible to be. Oh, yes, we may rightly tremble at the thought that we might find ourselves married to one, but candidates have had 1,000 years to be warned, and if in doubt, Seller and Yateman are a quick and easy read.
8 legs worse.
The other evening I found myself looking at what appeared to be a tiny broken bagpipe. It was leaking. It was, furthermore, leaking something black, and, furthermost, lying in what it was leaking. None of this would have mattered much had I found myself looking at it in, say, a hospital pedal bin. I should merely have shuddered and walked on. but what I found myself looking at it in was a dish. The dish was on a table in front of me, flanked by knives, forks and spoons. In short, all the accoutrements required if what you were going to do with a tiny broken bagpipe was not shudder and walk on, but eat it. Not that there was any if about it. I was a guest. The tiny bagpipe had been cooked by my hostess. All the other guests had one too, and they were uniformly thrilled by them. "Oh, wow," they cried, "squid! Stuffed squid," they elaborated. "Oh, wow, its own ink. Oh, wow." I looked at mine. I gave it a little prod with my fork. Ink ran out of it. Though not a household name where marine biologists foregather, I know why the squid has ink in it. It is so that it can squirt it out to put off predators attempting to eat it. It works. And not mind that it seemed to bother the others. They couldn't wait to tuck in. They sliced off the tentacles, they sectioned the body, they spooned up the ink to choral humming and ooing, punctuated by brief autobiographical solos about how they'd always wanted to cook squid. It looked so wonderfully marbled, but they'd never dared. Were they alive when you bought them? How did you kill them? How did you clean them? How did you stuff them? How did you find out how to... My point exactly, as a matter of fact, though not with me, uttered ecstatically, just brooded on internally. As indeed they had been with the first course, shorba, when everyone had shrilled, "Oh, wow, isn't this that fantastic Yemeni marrowbone soup? Yes, it is. Oh, what's it called?" But I'd managed to get that down all right. I'd succeeded in persuading myself that wherever the marrow had been extruded, it was unlikely to have been from camel bones. I didn't think you could buy camel bones in barns. I would have heard. There were little fibrous lumps floating about in it, mind, that could have been goat, possibly hare, but I managed to corral them under my reverse spoon, and I don't think anyone noticed. Now, don't misinterpret all this gustatory whinging. I am no culinary philistine. I've tied on the bib at many an ethnic bistro, and not shrunk from having a cockshy at the arcane, even when I have not had the slightest idea what yuck-yuck or bugatti were, and the patron lacked the bilingualism to convey. I have probably eaten wild toad in a wart sauce and held up my plate for more. I may even have been asked on the drive home whether I liked the stuffed nostril and not stopped the car to throw up. It isn't a question of squeamishness over this exotic dish or that, only one of suspicion and unease when faced with the ambitions of the amateur. For while it is one thing to order tiger stew from an Ulaanbaatar restaurateur with three rosettes in the Mongolian Michelin, it's quite another to have it ladled out before you in Stoke Newington by an English ophthalmologist whose hobby is deciphering Oriental cookbooks. And there's a lot of that about these days. The British, for whom a new eating world opened with the immigration of countless entrepreneurs carrying woks, pasta makers, clay ovens, fondue sets, spice mills and all the rest, and bent under sacks of enigmatic herbs, vats of curious oils, and unfathomable lengths of dried animal, the British have become the acolytes of 100 different cuisines, eager not merely to patronise the professional establishments, but, God help us, to emulate them to the best of their domestic ability. A best which is not always good enough. It isn't just the cooking, either. It's the trust one is required to have in what went on before they got to the cooking, which is why, when that other evening someone asked how you cleaned a squid, I had a long pull of the merso and tried to think about something else. God knows what there is inside a squid. I remembered once watching Poulper preparing to market their catch on the Marseille waterfront. They killed the squid by sticking their thumbs in the beaks and turning the bodies inside out, whereupon they chucked the entrails back in the sea because there were poison sacks inside. Had my barn's hostess known enough to do that? I wasn't sure. So I just set the tentacles. "Phew," I said when the plates came to be collected, and an eyebrow raised itself over my little legless bagpipe. That was one big squid. Do you know, I couldn't manage another bite.
Dem bones, dem bones.
I really hate things that happened half a million years ago. There are so few of them. Or rather, there are so few of them that we know about. The result is that we can easily go crazy speculating about half-million-year-old things we don't know about, based on the few things we do know about. I haven't slept properly since Friday. On Friday, I learnt that half a million years ago, Boxgrove Man lost a tooth. Until Friday, I knew only that Boxgrove Man had lost a shin. Archaeologists found the shin a year ago. It was surrounded by a lot of rhino bones, following which discovery I was left speculating as to whether the rhinos had eaten the rest of Boxgrove Man, or whether Boxgrove Man had eaten the rest of the rhinos. The archaeologist didn't seem prepared to say until a little later, unable to leave well enough alone, they discovered a large number of stone axes from which they risked deducing that these were used by Boxgrove Man to help him eat the rhinos. They announced, "The indication is that the site was used 500,000 years ago for butchering big game." I couldn't see why we had to accept this. It seemed to me equally likely that Boxgrove Man had sat there napping all these axes, possibly with a view to going out and killing rhinos, true, but was taken by surprise when the rhinos snuck up on him. Nor did the fact that so many rhinos died on the site necessarily mean they were butchered there. It is equally possible that eating Boxgrove Man did not agree with them. They might have finished their meal and keeled over. You will argue that rhinos are vegetarian, but they're not vegetarian out of principle. They might have decided to become vegetarian 500,000 years ago after eating Boxgrove Man. I had only just started sleeping properly again when the archaeologists issued a further statement saying it was a mystery why Boxgrove Man had made so many axes, but it suggested that a group of perhaps 30 people collaborated in the task of dismembering the carcasses. Does it? I would suggest that while the concept of Boxgrove family butchers is admittedly a possibility, we are in no position, 500,000 years on, to rule out Boxgrove Bistro. There's no reason, if you accept their original thesis that Boxgrove Man killed Boxgrove Rhino rather than vice versa, why he should not then have napped a full canteen of stone cutlery for 30 and set up in the fast food business. I lay awake for many a dark hour thinking about this. If it were so, how did customers pay? Philologists might argue that Boxgrove Diner would not have developed enough language to ask for the bill. But I should counter this by pointing out that few people ever use language for that. They just make a sort of scribbling sign in the air, well within the competence of a race deft enough to nap flints. Mind you, did they realise that they were expected to pay at all? Might this explain the lone shin? Did the diners, enraged at discovering that they had not in fact been invited round for a free hot rhino dinner, plus all the trimmings, fall on Boxgrove Man and tear him limb from limb? I got back to sleep around early August, and had a pretty good month until last Friday when Boxgrove Tooth turned up. All the archaeologists got terribly excited because it had a nasty cavity with bits of food in it, which was why, they said, it fell out. I was going along with that and looking forward to a decent night's kip when they let slip their belief that Boxgrove Tooth had belonged to different Boxgrove Man because it was a couple of centuries older than Boxgrove Shin, having been found several feet beneath it. What makes them so sure? Is it not equally possible that different Boxgrove Man simply lived downstairs? There is no reason why Boxgrove Bistro should not have been on an upper floor. Many restaurants are actually on roofs. Unless, of course, it was on the ground floor, and the bloke with toothache lived in the basement. Then again, maybe he was just visiting. After only 500,000 years, it is, in my insomniac opinion, far too early to dismiss the possibility of Boxgrove Dentist.
Crickle Ward, you stole my youth away. For I was young and innocent, and you were old and grey.
Cor Corran was written and read by Alan Corran and produced by Arid Evans.
For I was young and innocent, and you were old and grey.